I'm Greg Johnson.
And I'm John Morgan.
I'm Michael Polignano.
Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. So this is our second weekly show, and we're going to begin this week by thanking some donors for helping us out. We've had two donations since our last show, but one of them has been quite substantial. So I want to thank Dee for a gift of $1,000. And also a friend who writes for us for a $50 donation. Gentlemen, thank you both for your help. We really appreciate it.
Yes, thanks a lot. That helps all of us. So all of us at Countercurrents, thank you.
Thank you very much, guys. I certainly appreciate it as well. It's great to know that you're with us and supporting us.
Terrific. So let's talk a bit about Donald Trump's recent visit to Poland, and also his visit at the G20. I was really impressed. I thought it was sort of a white-pilling experience. I felt like the old Trump that I voted for and liked was very much back. And I just wonder what you guys think about this as a sign, perhaps, of things to come. You're there in Central Europe, so you're getting, I hope, the Central European buzz. What are your thoughts about it? Do you want to go first, John?
Well, I like everybody else, I mean, after what's happened over the last few months, especially with Syria, you know, that was a bit of a black pill. I think I became rather pessimistic, like many of us did. But it seems like when Trump is overseas, he becomes more like the Trump that we knew in the campaign, which is very good. I don't know what the reason for that is. Maybe it's because he gets away from all the Russia scandal and the other squabbles that are going on. But I also felt it in May when there was that NATO summit, and he also kind of stood up to the Eurocrats, as they call them here. And I felt like this time as well, he seemed to go back to the sort of principles that he was talking about during the campaign. I would say that the speech that he gave in Poland was very inspiring. Certainly, there was one editorial I saw yesterday accusing Trump of having given an alt-right speech in Poland, and you know, repeatedly using the term alt-right, and basically, you know, attacked him for having taken this America First stance and talking about the need for Westerners to band together against the Islamic threat and the fact that identity was under threat. This is something that they were very much against. So I took that as a sign that that was a very successful speech from our perspective. I don't know if it was Bannon or is it Miller, his other speechwriter?
Miller, I believe, was the author of it, yes.
Yeah, they seem to be very much in tune with our ideas. So, you know, I saw that as something very good. But and then at the G20 as well, you know, I mean, things aren't perfect. I mean, there's still a lot of problems with Putin and with Russia. I mean, I never really expected that he was going to be able to solve everything in one fell stroke. But you know, still, it seems like he got along with Putin, and maybe there's some hope for some progress in that regard. I certainly don't think he's on a collision course like Clinton would have been in that situation. So I thought it was very good, although you asked what Central Europeans have thought of everything that's going on. And all along, when I've talked to Hungarians about this, I don't think they really know exactly what to make of Trump. I mean, somebody like him, I mean, he has a very American style. And it's the kind of thing that wouldn't really play in Hungarian politics, I don't think. So I don't think they know exactly what to make of him in this context. But at least people on the right recognize that he has some principles that in some ways accord with what they want. So, you know, they certainly welcomed what he did in Poland. Just as the Polish people did. Although I don't get the sense of that if he came here, he would have the sort of exuberant greeting that the Polish people seemed to give him, where, you know, he was kind of welcomed as you know, some sort of conquering hero or something like that, which I thought was interesting, at least judging from the video.
Mm-hmm. Mike, what are your thoughts?
That's very interesting that you say, John, about the Hungarian impression of Trump's speech. I was talking.
Just to clarify, I wasn't referring to his speech specifically. I haven't actually asked anybody about that, but I just meant my impression of how Hungarians react to Trump generally.
Generally, okay. I was just speaking with one of the local identitarians here in Budapest who we were hanging out with earlier tonight, and he told me that the Hungarian newspapers and opinion makers here actually construed his meeting with Putin as more favorable to Putin, that Putin was presenting himself as more the dominant party in that interaction, whereas in all the American writers that I've read, that they all seem to have written about Trump's body language in that interaction, signifying he was the one who was setting the tone and more dominant, which I thought was interesting to see, to know the difference in perception as far as that goes. Regarding Trump's speech in Poland specifically and his appearance at the G20 in relation to that, I think he really did use this as an opportunity to draw a line between the Visegrad states and Western Europe in regards to the future direction of NATO and of Europe and the European Union. Because, of course, Poland is an EU member state and also a NATO member. And he used the opportunity in his speech to talk about the West in a way that was fundamentally different from the way all politicians have discussed the West in the post-World War II world order during the Cold War and post-Cold War era. He used it in the sense of Western civilization, and you know, that definitely set off alarm bells among liberal outlets about, you know, him taking the side of the West in the clash of cultures and everything. And, you know, he specifically asked if the West has the will to survive, and used Poland as an example of a country in which the West does exemplify that spirit. And I think that this was definitely, you know, old school Trump. This was, you know, definitely Bannon influenced. And I think it was great to hear him actually say that in a speech and reaffirm that.
I can see what you're saying, Mike. But friend of mine mentioned who I was talking to about this, and I kind of saw the point that he was making is, couldn't we say, though, that this is almost a return to Reagan era rhetoric, because he was talking about Western civilization, but if you really look specifically at what he was addressing when he talked to the Poles, I mean, he was very clearly excluding Russia from that. And like from a new right or a white nationalist perspective, that's still kind of problematic, because, you know, he's basically saying that, well, you know, the West is this sort of Atlanticist, I guess you could say, democratic body that's fighting this kind of Eastern menace from Russia. So do you think it was really revolutionary, or is this just a return to kind of Cold War style rhetoric for Trump?
Well, in terms of realpolitik, there's no way he can align himself and American interests with Russian interests overtly in that sort of fashion.
Right.
You know,
and he certainly can't say that in Poland.
I mean, no.
the Poles would have none of that. They would have run him out of Warsaw on a rail if he had done that. So I do think it was sort of Reagan-like, the speech. I think you're right about that, John. It was kind of Cold War-ish, but then he not only underscored the fact that there is still a Russian enemy, to and the Poles certainly believe that. That's why they're part of NATO, right? But also, I think he pivoted to the whole thing about the migrant crisis and immigration and terrorism and Islam very nicely in this speech. So I do think that that was important. On the one hand, the whole speech was civic nationalist in its basic conception, because he talked about Western values, but he did speak of ancestors and things like that, which I thought was a nod to history and tradition and blood and soil kinds of concerns. But he talked about, you know, the common values of the West. And yet the thing that was most impressive to me and most alarming to the left is he said that there's something more than just principles, there's something more than just material, and that is the moral level of the West, our will to survive, our animal vitality, our willingness to take our own side in fights, that kind of issue. And he really, I thought, was eloquent in talking about those dimensions of politics, and that's a very fundamental dimension of politics.
Yes.
And we haven't heard an American leader speak in those terms in a very long time. Somebody pointed out that when George W. Bush went to Warsaw, he gave a speech that did not mention the West or defending the West. He gave a speech about fighting AIDS in Africa. I think that is pretty indicative of the distance we have traveled between this Republican president and the last Republican president that we had.
Yes.
The last Republican that we had, president that we had, was just an extreme globalist, basically. The very idea that he would go to Poland and talk about something like that, as opposed to talk about something of vital national importance to the Poles, I thought that's extraordinary. And Trump knows where the red meat in politics is. It's about identity. It's about us versus them. And he established that Poland and the United States are aligned. They've been aligned ever since the prehistory, the birth pangs of the United States, when Poles helped our Revolutionary War. And, you know, there were Polish immigrants who came, and we have helped Poland, both during the Cold War, clandestinely, and after the Cold War came to an end, after it became independent. And I thought it was quite extraordinary. I mean, he's dealing with real politics in the sense of us versus them, rather than globalist nostrums and wishful thinking. And it's important because Poland, as well as Hungary and the Czech Republic and to some extent Slovakia, the Visegrad countries, are all opposed to the EU policies of trying to force more migrants onto the continent, and especially
yes.
into those countries. And I think that Trump...
the only ones in the EU.
Yeah, and Trump is... Trump was signaling his support of that. I think that was one major message you have to take away from the speech. Trump is on the side of these countries fighting against ethnic displacement by Islam, especially. He's on their side. And that's a really powerful message to the EU in favor of European nationalism and the healthiest European nationalism in Central Europe right now.
That's true, and I have to wonder also, I mean, this is kind of a personal detail, but Trump's, he's always had a taste for Eastern European partners in his married life. I wonder if that's played any role in his sort of view of the world as well. I mean, I have no idea what pillow talk he's had with Melania or his other wives, but...
Ivana, his first wife, was Czech. Melania was is Slovenian. Mm. So, yeah, he's definitely done 2 out of 3 wives who are Slavic immigrants, which is quite interesting. Of course, Czech pillow talk about the Russians is going to be kind of dark, I would imagine.
I suspect so as well.
Yeah, probably less so with Slovenians because they never actually were, as far as I know, occupied by Russians. So, that is an interesting thing, though. He he certainly at least has a taste for and blood ties to Central Europe and the Slavic world, which is fascinating.
What is the impression of the Baltic states? They, you know, as far as I'm aware, they have not been asked to take in a sizable number of migrants. It's been Poland and Chechia and Slovakia and Hungary that have really been asked to shoulder that burden as far as the EU. But I wonder what their stance has been, if there's been any statement on behalf of the leaders of those countries regarding this issue.
Well, from what I know in Estonia, you know, they generally don't want them. They've taken a few of these people. And I think one of the things that's happened, though, is they've taken them on the assumption that they're not going to stay very long anyway. So a number of these migrants went to Latvia, and practically as soon as they got their papers, they left for greener welfare states, basically in Scandinavia or Germany. So I think these countries are sort of engaged in malicious compliance, if you will, with the EU, knowing that it's not actually going to harm them because they don't have enough of a welfare state in any of the Baltic countries to make them attractive destinations for loafers, basically. So they come there, they get their papers, and they leave. Now, if there was a real threat of larger numbers of them coming and staying, I think they would turn on a dime, probably, and they would be on the side of the V4. I think very, very certainly they would. And that's even though they have, you know, cucky centralist Eurocrat governments. But the thing about a lot of these Central and Eastern European countries is, when you get right down to it, even the left is pretty nationalistic. So when I was in Estonia, I think I mentioned this last week, the Estonian National Museum in Tartu and the National Art Museum in Tallinn were both premised on the idea that Estonia today is not a multicultural country. Basically, they were entirely focused on the Estonian people and the Russians, who make up a considerable percentage of the population today, were not treated as part of the Estonian nation. They just live there. They're not really Estonians. And I thought that was kind of amazing, because these are official government institutions, and chances are they're actually staffed and run by people who are centered to the left. But the underlying assumption is anti-multicultural, and I can't imagine that if Russians are considered to be in the country but not of it, that Syrians and Chechens and people like that, who are far more alien, would be considered good fits. But of course, you have this insanity in Britain where, you know, left-wing Britons will wax mournful and elegiac about the horrible history of the troubles between the Irish and the English. And then they'll say, but Pakistanis make a great fit.
Yes.
Let's hope they're not
Commonwealth people. Yeah, that's terrific.
Yeah. Let's hope that they're not that nuts there. I don't think they are yet, and maybe they never will be.
By the way, I just want to mention that editorial that I referenced earlier. The actual title is "The Alt-Right is an Attack on Western Values. Liberals Shouldn't Surrender So Easily," and it was in the Washington Post yesterday, which is July 12th. Accusing Trump's speech in Poland of being an alt-right speech, essentially.
Well, what specifically did they accuse it of being alt-right for? What were the statements?
I haven't read this, but they quote an Atlantic writer who was commenting on the Poland speech as saying, "Trump did everything but cite Pepe the Frog." and apparently Vox wrote, "Trump's speech in Poland sounded like an alt-right manifesto." But basically, what they accuse Trump of doing is of defining the West as something that's defined by Europeans and people of European descent, rather than of being embodied by the liberal values that grew up here.
Right. In the last three centuries.
Yeah. Yes, yeah, which, I mean, they do have a point. I mean, liberalism did take root in the West, but, I mean, that's why we of the true right, as I like to call it, we actually think that that's you know, that there's a tie between ethnicity and a culture as well, that you can't have a valid culture that just accepts anybody who happens to be there as a member.
Right. Liberal values are not universal, although it's one of our liberal values to be deluded about that fact and to think yes. that it's universal.
Absolutely. But, well, yeah. Every American president, you know, since World War II, more or less. I don't know how much Ike Eisenhower is behind this whole spreading liberal democracy throughout the world, or liberal values in the current sense of the word. It's you know, presented in the mainstream media. But every U.S. president, you know, with the exception of Trump, has basically taken the stance that, equated Western civilization with liberal democracy. And to finally have a break from that and to say, no, you know, Western civilization is much more than that. It's much broader is very refreshing.
Yeah, basically every basically the objection to this, the objection that it's alt-right boils down to the fact that Trump doesn't take liberalism to be a suicide pact. And I mean, that's pretty superficial and sad if not making ideology into a suicide pact makes you a far rightist. That should be, you know, 50 years ago, 60 years ago, even 40 years ago, that was a centrist position, probably. And that's the truth about Trump. Trump isn't a radical right winger, so much as the left has just become so mental, so pathological. Yes.
So extreme
that now he seems like a radical right winger from their perspective. But we can't let ourselves be fooled by their hysteria. We have to see the guy for what he is. And what he is a guy who's a centrist and whose policies in many ways are no further to the right wing than Jimmy Carter, for goodness sake. But everything's just slid so far into total insanity since then that now he's being decried as a right-wing extremist. And, of course, someday revisionists from the left will be decrying Jimmy Carter as a right-wing extremist too, probably.
Well, we've talked about Trump in Eastern Europe, but I think another interesting thing to look at in this perspective would be Western Europe's take, because we have... You know, Merkel in Germany, like, you know, she came out of the NATO summit, you know, basically saying that, well, Europe is on its own now. You know, and also after the G20, they were objecting to all the protectionist rhetoric, which I understand was attached to the fact that Trump claimed he wanted to raise tariffs and so forth on steel imports, specifically. But they objected to that. And, of course, this withdrawal from the climate change agreement. But now the other interesting aspect that's even more recent is now he's in France, and he's apparently got some kind of budding bromance going with Macron, who's been saying some peculiar things in the last few days about restoring the French monarchy and so forth.
Yeah, this Macron thing is kind of fascinating. It's kind of hilarious, too, because obviously what he was put up as is the stealth Socialist Party candidate. Hollande having ruined the Socialist Party brand, they simply found a Socialist Party member who was a kind of cipher and put him forward as their stealth candidate so he could be the... You know, the dray horse, you know, pulling for far globalism in the French presidency for the next 5 years. And it turns out that they might have put somebody in power that they didn't really vet very well or understand. He might actually be his own man. And he might also just be nuts. I mean, some of the stuff that he's saying recently makes me think that he's sort of a megalomaniac. He might actually be mentally unbalanced. And that's going to be hilarious to watch. So I'm getting my popcorn ready.
But didn't he make some comment just in the last couple of days about immigration that was really interesting?
Well, he said that the reason why, well, he says Africa has too many Africans in it. They're reproducing too much, and that Europe can't be expected to to basically take care of all the excess Africans, which is a sensible thing. I mean, De Gaulle would have said that. It's an interesting question to ask. Which French prime ministers or presidents would not have said that? Well, Hollande wouldn't have said that. Sarkozy might have said that, and everyone from Sarkozy back probably would have said that too. Anyway.
Although, of course, France is in a position where they can't even measure the number of French Africans they have in France.
Right. Fay writes about that, how they're not even allowed to report on the numbers.
Also, Bill Gates made a statement recently where he said that there are too many Africans coming into Europe and we need to make it much more difficult for them to come into to cross the Mediterranean Sea. And basically right now, he also said that we're incentivizing their transit across the Mediterranean into Europe, and that it's going to destroy Europe, which I thought was amazing.
It's good that he said that, although I have to say, I have to wonder how much Bill Gates really knows about... I mean, he probably doesn't really know much more than we do about the situation. I mean, it's good that he came to that conclusion, but I kind of wonder if he's just not, like, reading the same things we are and going, like, hey, this doesn't make any sense.
It's really interesting because, you know, he hasn't expressed interest in this at all before now. In fact, he's done, you know, Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation have done innumerable, you know, public service projects in Africa to come and just, you know, take this sort of stance now was after it's been going on for, you know, close to two decades now.
Yeah.
You know, it's just kind of shocking. You would think that these sorts of issues would be discussed at, you know, Bilderberg meetings and, you know, whatever other high-level conferences that are going on when these people speak with one another. But
well, I really can't imagine that people who have their finger on the pulse of global economics, I mean, obviously we as representatives of the true rights, I mean, we recognize that the important thing is particular values and culture. It's not economics, but for these people, you know, the people who basically are running the West today, I mean, obviously economics is what they see as the crucial factor in civilization. But I think even from their perspective, if you really look objectively at what's going on, how could it possibly end up being beneficial for them? I mean, to have to have the West inundated with people who, you know, first of all, can't even be identified, many of whom aren't even employable, and in many cases are hostile to their host nations. So maybe finally even the financial elite is waking up to these realities.
They've gotten to a point where they're threatening to kill the goose that's laying these eggs by making it impossible in these actual societies where the intelligent people are being born to...
You know, I mean, their birth rates being affected where they're sub-replacement levels, that there's just not going to be enough GDP, enough brain power to be able to support the cheap laborers who are coming in. And so it's going to fall apart.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's probably essentially the same logic as to why you see so many right-wing Jews coming over to our side now, because, you know, they've also realized that, well, you know, having a Europe that's Islamized is not going to be good for them.
We haven't really talked about the G20 meeting per se, and specifically about the Antifa on the streets and how they just kind of went wild and turned Germany into a third world country.
I haven't read extensively on that, but if you know something interesting, Mike, that might be worth bringing in.
Yeah. Well, they basically went out in force on the streets in Hamburg and were burning dumpsters and lighting cars on fire and smashing storefronts. And a reporter who was there on the scene reported that they actually discriminated between businesses to attack and which ones to leave alone based on whether or not the business displayed an Antifa flag or an anti-G20 sticker in the front of the building. And that was something that really kind of speaks to the totalitarianism of the left and how they're really just using violence to force everybody to conform.
There's no blinders about that anymore. It's just completely out in the open.
But the mainstream media outlets in Western Europe and America are not reporting on this. They're just leaving it out of their news stories and their editorials. You'll never hear about it in the Washington Post or the New York Times or.
That is interesting, although I have to say, from what I would consider a genuine right-wing perspective, though, I'm not unsympathetic to why. I mean, I recognize that this is really controlled opposition. I don't believe that these Antifa who were rioting in the streets were a genuine, anti-globalist force. But still, I have to say, if it had been another president other than Trump who was there, I think we would have a lot more sympathy for what they were doing, just because, they are basically protesting globalization, which is the same thing that we have a problem with, even if they approach it from a different angle. I just think it's important for us to keep our eye on the ball on that, even though we appreciate some of what Trump is doing, we shouldn't forget the fact that he's not really, like Greg said before, he's not really a true right representative.
Trump is Trump. He's a politician. He's been an entertainer for the past two decades nearly on mainstream television. He's one thing, but you have journalists like Lauren Southern being identified and then chased down, and the journalists who were with her were also marked as fascists and attacked by these people. And she is very against globalism.
The identitarians are very against globalism.
Well, I think that Antifa are basically against white people when you get right down to it. And being anti-globalization for a long time was a good proxy for being opposed to white people. And now that there are pro-white people who are anti-globalization, like Donald Trump, for instance, they're not turning on a dime because of their piety towards their principles of anti-globalization. They're just revealing what their real agenda is, which is anti-white, third worldist, and so forth. So any of these people who are sincerely anti-global will probably eventually come around to our way of thinking. But the people who gaslight them and organize them and get them out in the streets, they're not anti-globalization. They're just anti-white. It's like they're not pro-environment or anti-technology per se. They just use these things because these are good proxies for being opposed to white people, white civilization, Western civilization.
Right.
And, I mean, that's what the left has done. The left has morphed into all these different sock puppets since the Second World War, and especially since the end of the Cold War and the collapse of communism in Europe. They've basically gone out and found other garbs to hide behind. And but at a certain point, it became clear that the left wasn't even about workers. Right? It's about opposing Western civilization. It's about opposing white civilization. That's really what, in a way, it's probably always been about, at least the Jewish left, which has really been the core of the left ever since Marxism. So, I think it's perfectly logical that these anti-globalists are against Trump and against identitarianism because they're not really anti-globalists. And for a long time, their anti-globalization tendencies were just a good way of, a reliable way of fighting whites by proxy. And that's no longer true, though. So I imagine these people are going to change their spots. They'll change their brand eventually.
Well, you saw how the white working class in America came around and really saw that to be the case. saw that their interests were not being supported because they were white in this last election. And John, I was talking with you earlier today and during the past week.
You are more up to speed about some leftist intellectuals than I am. Specifically this Slavo Žižek. I know the identitarians here in Hungary are trying to organize a meeting between Žižek and Dugin. And you told me that Žižek is very opposed to some of the SJW left manifestations, such as promoting transsexuality and whatnot.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I actually find Žižek to be more interesting when he gives interviews and when he writes articles in newspapers and magazines than in his books, because he's kind of forced to be a little more coherent than he is in his books. But yeah, I mean, he identifies as a Marxist-Leninist, he'll say. He calls himself an old-fashioned Marxist-Leninist. And, I mean, if you look at the form of Marxist-Leninism in its original form, it was anti-liberal, at least economically and culturally to a certain extent. And he does actually adhere to those principles in certain respects. I mean, he's voiced support for, well, not exactly support, but he said that those in Europe who are protesting the migrant crisis, the allowing of the migrants into Europe, that Europe has to stop referring to them as fascists and has to take them seriously on their own terms. That was something that was good. And, you know, he's also talked about the whole transgender issue. And he said, I believe this was late last year, that, you know, the whole transgender crisis, as you would have it in Western Europe and the U.S., is basically a distraction of late capitalism. That it's, you know, as the capitalist system is decaying, they're throwing out these sort of fake issues for people to talk about, so they don't notice what's really going on, which would be sort of the solidification of the West into kind of a third world plantation, you know, where the super rich kind of govern over everybody else who's, you know, kept at bay at an extremely low level. So, yeah, in some sense, I mean, I certainly wouldn't say he's quote-unquote one of us, but on certain issues, he certainly said some interesting things. And, you know, something I've said all along is that the right shouldn't be afraid to engage with issues that are traditionally seen as left-wing issues. You know, I mean, environmentalism would be one. I mean, really, originally it was a right-wing issue. It was just co-opted by the left in the 60s. And globalization, too. I mean, it's seen as a left-wing thing, but really it's a right-wing issue, because it's right-wingers in all the countries of the world who believe that their own people have value and should, you know, be allowed to be independent and shouldn't be subject to the rule of forces that they can't control, and they're alien. So, yeah, you know, I think that I certainly don't think Žižek is the answer or the final word on this, but he's contributing to that discussion, I would say.
Well, he certainly reaches an entire huge audience that normally just completely tune out our ideas. And so where there are any areas of overlapping interest between the right and the far left, you know, this Marxist-Leninist, I think that definitely should be hashed out and discussed.
Well, I mean, here in Hungary, we have the Munkish Párt. I mean, they're very small. But, you know, for those who don't know anything about Hungarian politics, when communism ended in Hungary, the Communist Party that had ruled Hungary all during the Cold War split into the bigger component was the MSZP, which is today's Socialist Party. And they basically transformed themselves into a liberal socialist party along the lines of what you see in Western Europe. which basically means they claim to be socialist and so forth, but really what they want is more equality, more immigration, more multiculturalism, you know, this sort of thing. Thankfully, they haven't been very successful in Hungary in recent years. But there was another party that emerged at the same time, which is led by a man named Gyula Tirmer, who was a foreign minister in the 80s in the Hungarian government. And he wanted to see a party in Hungary that stayed true to, you know, what he saw as the original Marxist-Leninist principles of the country. And the Munkish part, surprisingly, I mean, they tend to stand alongside the right-wing parties much more often than they do the left. You know, they frequently agree with Jobbik and with Fidesz. Fidesz is the ruling party, and Jobbik is sort of the more further to the right party, which is the second most popular party in Hungary. They stand with them on most issues, including on immigration. So, you know, I do see that there is a you know, a potential for sort of a meeting of the minds, as it were, between the far left and the far right. Although, you know, I still think we have to keep in mind that in the end, you know, we do want different things, but we can certainly learn from each other, and maybe even to a certain extent, there's even room for cooperation. But yeah, you know, it's a, you know, classic thinking outside the box kind of thing. You know, sometimes you're the person who is actually the most opposed to you, intellectually speaking, actually may have more in common with you than the enemies that aren't as extreme. So,
yeah, that's interesting. Let's segue a bit into the final portion of our show today, which is our shop talk segment, where we just talk about upcoming projects from Countercurrents. Just let our listeners, our followers in on what's to come. I have been working very hard this week with our cover designer, Kevin Slaughter, getting covers done for a couple of books. And we have a cover now for a collection of interviews called You Asked For It, which is a collection of 12 interviews that I've done over the years between 2012 and 2017. And the volume, I'm kind of proud of this volume, to be quite honest, because it's, well, it's just a new slant on a lot of things that I've been saying. A lot of memes and arguments that I've been saying for years were first coined in these particular interviews and have been refined in further interviews and also in essays, articles that I've published. And the volume sort of stands alone as a statement of my views on a lot of things from a North American New Right, white nationalist kind of perspective. It's about 250 pages long, so it's a quite substantial book. It has a quite handsome cover, thanks to Kevin Slaughter. And I am working feverishly to get this finished up. I hope that I'll have it out later in the month of July, perhaps in time to take some copies to American Renaissance with me. And I've also been working with Kevin on the cover of this new Jonathan Bowden anthology, which is called Extremists. And John, you've been doing work on that too.
Yes, yeah, I'm nearly done with that. I'm just the editing is finished, and I'm just checking the transcripts of the interviews against the original audio recordings. But that should be done very soon. I think people will find this very interesting. I mean, basically, it's Bowden talking about the most extreme figures that he ever spoke about. You know, Avila is in there, Savitri Devi, Martin Heidegger. He talks about somebody who apparently was a sort of intellectual mentor to him, who I didn't even know about, Maurice Cowling, who was a sort of historian who wrote about how Britain evolved away from being a monarchy into a more liberal state. And I found it quite fascinating. Oh, also in there is a transcript of his talk on Martin Heidegger, which when I first started listening to Bowden's talks, I was very impressed with that one.
Yeah, there's an essay on, or a talk on D'Annunzio, a talk on Morat, a talk about Mishima, Savitri Devi. There are a total of 9 lectures in here. 8 of them are on individual extremist figures, and then one is called Vanguardism, Hope for the Future. And basically what this book does is illustrates 3 things that Bowden referred to again and again, which is the importance of metapolitics, metapolitical ideas, the importance of extremists as those people who create culture and advance culture, and the importance of a vanguardist strategy for the right, of actually leading and changing the public mind on fundamental issues, including metapolitical issues. And he gives you a lot of interesting information about people like Carlyle, but he also hits these points again and again about the importance of metapolitics, the importance of vanguardism, and the creative importance of people that are often dismissed as way too extreme. And yet, in many ways, we are living in the dregs of the worst extremist fantasies of in the 20th and 21st centuries. A few years ago, this transgenderism craze would have been, you know, dismissed as lunacy. If you said this was going to happen, no one would be so extreme. And yet here we are in the midst of this. So extremists often end up dragging all the rest of us along with them for good or ill. And there are good extremists and bad extremists. And Bowden shares a lot of his insights about the good kind in this particular volume.
I would say he also stresses in many of these lectures, he stresses the importance of intellectuals. And he always says that you can't judge the success of a thinker in terms of his audience, because, you know, the importance of an idea, you know, can't be gauged in that sort of populist way that we've been trained to think in, because, you know, he might be influencing people who actually are very influential in circles that actually have power. But that's something that's much more difficult to gauge than popularity.
Yeah, quantity and quality are often different things. And sometimes just because you have a very large audience doesn't mean that you actually have an audience that can deliver real power, right? And
yes.
So oftentimes it's very elitist and arcane forms of discourse that can influence people who have their fingers on the levers of power. And that's what we want, ultimately. We want to influence people whose fingers are on the levers of power. And eventually we want to be those people. And we need to start acting like it and act our way into actually being in that position. So those are a couple of projects, and there are going to be audiobooks of these too, because the Bowden pieces are all based on audio of speeches. And fortunately, a couple of the audios are just terrible. I don't think they're just not listenable. So the transcribers who worked on these projects did really heroic efforts to actually deliver the content to us, because most of us could never just sit and listen to a couple of these things. But others have really good audio quality, and so we'll put out an audiobook of the Bowden pieces, at least the best of them. And we're also going to put out an audiobook of these interviews of mine. And the third project that we might mention is the first volume of the Countercurrents interviews, which are interviews that Mike Polignano and I, primarily Mike Polignano and I, have done with other people at Countercurrents. And we've done quite a number of these interviews. They're very interesting, in-depth interviews in many cases. And we're going to continue bringing out collections of these transcripts as well as audiobooks of these interviews, so we can give them a new life. Because, you know, 5 years, 6 years ago, 7 years ago, when we were doing interviews, our listenership, our viewership was a fraction of what it is today. And so we should always be willing to just repeat stuff, because chances are we have a large audience of new people who haven't heard these things yet.
Right.
So that's one of the reasons why we revisit these old things. We pick out the best of them and we try and give them new life by reprinting them or printing them as books and putting them out again as also audio books as well.
Absolutely. I'm particularly proud of this collection that's coming out. These interviews were all done back in the early days of Countercurrents during our first 3 years, when we started Countercurrents Radio in the beginning of 2012, and our first interviewee was actually an Israeli filmmaker named Yoav Shamir, who had created a documentary named Defamation, which really got on the ADL's nerves and, you know, Abe Foxman's nerves, and who denounced Shamir as basically an anti-Semite.
I really think highly of that documentary, Defamation. It's really worth seeing.
And, you know, there are other lots of really interesting interviews in there as well. Greg and I interview Charlie Kraft a few times.
Yeah, those are always good.
I hope you all take a look and enjoy both the audiobook and
the actual printed book when they are released.
A couple other things that we're moving to press in the next month or two. There's a novel by Spencer Quinn, who's written quite a lot for Countercurrents over the last year and a half or so, called White Like You. And there is a collection of his essays called Reframing White Nationalism. There is a collection of short stories by J.A. Nichol called Venus and Her Thugs, which contains a lot of new works as well as some works that were published at Countercurrents. Chris Pankhurst has a volume called Numinous Machines that we're putting the final touches on. I just got the corrected index back for Kerry Bolton's book, More Artists of the Right. That's my title, my scintillating, brilliant title. I thought it might be better than Artists of the Right, too, right? But anyway, More Artists of the Right contains essays on people like Wagner, T.S. Eliot, Aleister Crowley. Crowley, of course, was more known as an esotericist and an occultist, but he was also a poet and novelist as well, definitely an artist. Also, Count Pataki of Montauk. There's a long essay on Pataki in there that's quite interesting. A really interesting essay on Rex Fairburn, also from New Zealand. And a very good essay on Mishima. So it's a quite good volume. There's also an essay on P.R. Stevenson, the Australian writer. And that really just needs a cover. So after we get the Bowden cover done, I'm going to try and get to work on the cover for the Bolton book. And there's another book that has been languishing without a cover, Fenech Soler's book, Rising. We have that out with a different cover designer. So I'm going to write a little note today just to urge that along as well. But there is quite a lot coming out from Countercurrents in the balance of the summer and into the fall. So please keep watching this website, and we'll give you updates every week in our little Shop Talk segment. Well, guys, I think we've had a good conversation today. Next week, we're going to have an interview with Christopher Robertson, who is the author of In Defense of Hatred and a number of articles, and he spoke at the most recent Northwest Forum. He's a really fine writer and interesting guy, so we're going to be reading through his book and interviewing him for our next episode. So I hope you'll join us in a week's time, and thank you for being listeners to Countercurrents Radio.
Thanks a lot. It was our pleasure.
It was great having this conversation with both you guys and with our listening audience as well.